This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guests this morning are David and Michael Hansen. David is a freelance journalist who was the founding travel editor for Cottage Living magazine. Michael is an award-winning photographer who shoots for the New York Times, Outside, Patagonia, Coastal Living, and NPR, among others. Brothers David and Michael Hansen have collaborated on documentary and multimedia projects for the last 5 years, including work on Apalachicola Bay oysters, Ethiopian coffee, Chilean Andes gold mine, and Pacific Northwest timber. David and Michael Hansen are here today to tell us about their book, Breaking Through Concrete, Building an Urban Farm Revival, co-authored with Edwin Marti and published in 2012. Welcome.
Thank you.
What prompted you to write your book, Breaking Through Concrete?
It came about over years of seeing urban farms sprouting up across the country. I was a writer at the time with the magazine and was covering new smart growth developments and saw a lot of urban farms and food growing areas going into those neighborhoods and into residential areas. And my buddy, Edwin Marti, we were both in Birmingham, had started an urban farm in Birmingham, which really transformed that city over its 10 years. So we kind of had our finger on the pulse of urban farms and decided that while there's some talk about it and a lot of talk of farm to plate, we didn't see any book that was really celebrating what the different aspects of urban farming was and kind of trying to show in a very visual way what this urban farm movement means.
What is your definition of an urban farm?
We ended up defining an urban farm as any place in a city that grows food that is not to be consumed only by the person growing it. Basically, I just boiled that down. Because I think when people think of urban farms, they think of a lot of things. And the easiest thing to come to mind is just the corner garden where a group of neighbors grow, like in the pea patches in Seattle. That's kind of a foundation to the urban farm, but there's dozens of more ways that they come into play in cities beyond just growing food. And so they offer these social services and a lot of things that transcend just the idea of growing food.
Would you like to give an overview of your trip around the U.S. to look at the urban farms?
Well, we started with buying a short school bus in Ballard that slept three and had a kitchen and a little work desk. And it was more of a production vehicle, but it was a pretty sexy way to travel around the country if you're going to be looking at urban farming. And it ran on veggie grease that we found. We started in Ballard and we drove down through California and pretty much across the country. The bus ended up dying in Birmingham, Alabama. It died many times on the way, but it really the last time was in Birmingham, Alabama. And we finished the trip in a pretty boring minivan, finished it up in Chicago. And it was 2 months long and 12 cities.
How did you go about choosing the farms that you visited?
Well, that's a good question, because I think, you know, we want to be clear that there's only 12 farms highlighted in the book, and we were pretty conscientious in choosing those because there's hundreds of farm projects going on around the city, from the tiniest little selling tomatoes to, you know, acres of working production farms in cities. So Edwin and I kind of parsed out this list of a lot of the farms we were seeing and then kind of broke it down into what we wanted to tell about what is an urban farm. And so it's an education farm, it's a job training, it's sometimes it's homeless kind of reassimilation into society farm, like with a homeless garden project and with a recently incarcerated project, backyard gardens. So we broke all those down, and then we placed the farms that we thought best represented those aspects and with a regional diversity. So we kind of shaped it to tell the story of the big picture of the urban farms and tell it across the entire country.
What size range were the farms that you visited, the biggest to the smallest?
The farm in Chicago is a peri-urban farm example, and that was 90 acres of organic farmland preserved within a new residential community. But it's on this peri-urban zone. Basically, it's the area where the suburbs hit the rural farmland. So there's a lot of acres there. So within those 90 acres that were preserved, there's a 50-acre farm run by a family growing amazing vegetables and making money out of that farm. Within the cities, 2 to 3 acres was about the largest. The smallest was the Eagle Street rooftop farm in Brooklyn, which is on a warehouse roof, which is 6,000 square feet.
Or you could look at the New Orleans and backyard gardens, which are just small backyard plots growing food. And collectively, they're large, but on an individual basis, those are pretty small.
Well, you've been alluding to this, but what types of urban spaces have been chosen for urban farming?
Most of them started in vacant lots. Kind of this whole movement has been around this kind of guerrilla gardening concept, which is there's vacant lots in a lot of our cities, and let's use those and grow food because we live locked in this city. and we were forced to get our food at a grocery store. So why don't we start growing our own? That's how it started in a lot of places. Beyond just the let's grow food on this vacant lot, the more intentional projects have really come at it with let's grow food and let's use a farm in a city as a way to promote good food, connect people to their food, and also, again, create jobs, educate youth, educate adults.
How would you characterize the people involved in urban farming?
Well, they're quite the spectrum. You know, the young, I can think of a couple examples in the rooftop garden in New York. Annie Novak is a young girl who runs that farm. And then down in New Orleans, the backyard garden in the Versailles community, East New Orleans, is all driven by the elderly and retired. So there's quite the spectrum. I would say most of them fall within the 30s to 40s as part of this new movement of not only connecting people to their food and education and training, but also as hopefully, and in many instances, a way to make a living.
I think one of the myths, interesting myths about urban farms around the country, and especially in a city like Seattle, where we live in Seattle, and so we've seen this here in our own backyards, is that urban farms are kind of this hobby garden thing for yuppies or hipsters or something. And I like to think that our book blows that perception out of the water, that you go around the country and you start really looking at who these farmers are, and it's the broadest spectrum of America as you could find. And that was really cool. That was one of the coolest surprises out of this book, I think.
Would you say more about the reasons people had for deciding to do urban farming?
That's a big question. I think, you know, in the big, big picture of things, there's this undercurrent, I feel like, of kind of getting back to our roots. It's almost like a back to the land movement in a different shape than the previous one. But kind of handmade, do it yourself, that's a big thing. And we see it in our food. We see it in people wondering about where the sources of their consumer items are coming from. And I think that also chefs, the high-end restaurants that are doing this farm to plate are being a market engine that is supporting a lot of these urban farm projects. So entrepreneurs can literally say, well, do I want to, you know, start a small business making widgets? Or maybe I could start a small business growing food and selling it to these three great restaurants around the neighborhood and making a profit. So I think there's the social aspect of let's create something that's going to make this neighborhood that might be blighted more beautiful. And then there's also the economic aspect of let's do something that we can actually make a living doing this and feel good about it and be outside.
Would you like to speak about the role of immigrants in the urban farms that you visited?
Yeah, immigrants are really interesting. We saw in Denver and in Kansas City and in New Orleans especially, distinct immigrant populations. In Denver and Kansas City, it's Bhutan, Somalia, and Sudan refugees largely who have come over within the last 10 years, really. And they come from agrarian societies where they grow food in their backyards, and that's what they do, and it's kind of their third place. It's where they gather as a community, and it's just natural to them. And so then they get here, and they get placed in kind of outlying city urban areas like in Denver and Kansas City, and they don't have that access to the soil. And so like in Denver, they found vacant lots again, coming back to kind of the root of these urban farms, and they just started growing there and didn't have any support. And eventually the organizations that have grown up around urban farms saw what was going on and started to support them. But in Kansas City, there's an incubator project that helps women who've moved over and don't have a direct line into the workforce in the U.S. to use their skills as growers to start small farm businesses and growing organic produce and then selling it at the markets that this Cultivate Kansas City organization helps promote and set up. And so those women now have a kind of a value within their neighborhood, within their community, within their families. They're bringing some income to the home and bringing fresh food to the home. So the refugees are really an interesting part of the urban farm puzzle. Again, a surprising piece.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guests are David and Michael Hansen, co-authors with Edwin Marti of the book Breaking Through Concrete, Building an Urban Farm Revival. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. To what extent has urban farming been combined with providing social services for the community? Would you like to speak about the farms on your tour that did that?
A quick rundown. Santa Cruz is a homeless garden project. They have a 3-year training program for homeless people straight off the streets. They come in and they work the farm. They get job training with the hopes that in 3 years they'll be able to assimilate back into society. This similar program in Chicago, south side of Chicago, called Growing Home, works with recently incarcerated, released from prison citizens. And they work for a growing season. They work in the mornings on the farm. Then they have classroom job skill lessons in the afternoon. And then Thirdly, in Seattle alone, just looking at one pea patch, which we did, we looked at a bunch, but on one particular pea patch, there was a man who had started clearing the land to start that pea patch, was a young man, was growing food, kind of back to the earth scene back then. And now he ended up starting the food bank project and hospice project through the pea patches so that they're growing to donate to those programs in the city. And now he is actually an older man now, and he's a recipient of that food bank program. So that was kind of a full circle example of how the pea patch grew out of this community energy around growing food, but also bringing it into needy parts of the community.
What are your thoughts on why urban farms are appearing right now, why they're becoming so popular?
I think, again, it comes back to this larger idea of let's control what we're consuming and have our hands on the things that we're using every day. And especially, you know, there's hardly anything more intimate than food. It's something you're putting in your body three times a day. And so I think that just this general energy toward sustainability and toward, again, just having that control, I think urban farms allow you to kind of bypass what's been built around us, this industrial food system that's been built around us, and go directly to your food source. And I think that's appealing to a lot of people right now.
I think people like to connect to see where things come from, and especially their food. And if most people are living in the city, then having an urban farm makes sense to see and know where their stuff is coming from, and in this case, know where their food's coming from and know who's growing it and what's going in it.
Well, the urban farms that you've spoken about fulfill a lot of different functions, but to what extent are they for-profit ventures, the ones that you visited?
I think all of them are trying and evolving toward this triple bottom line, which is hitting the social, the economic, and the environmental fronts as a business. And I think, you know, obviously we've got lots of one- and two-dimensional corporations and businesses out there that are hitting great financially and maybe missing on social and environmental. And I think, again, kind of the environmental movement and the urban farm movement may have started out with this, we can just grow food and maybe we'll get donations and maybe we'll operate as a nonprofit. And all that's great, and there's a space for the nonprofit urban farm, just like there's space for any other nonprofit in a community. But what's really interesting to see is how a lot of the leaders within the urban farm movement are moving beyond that and trying to go over this spectrum of food. And they think that that's how the urban farm is going to infiltrate the larger food system in a really positive way, and making it a for-profit operation. You know, I think that for its long-term sustainability, these ideas being espoused on urban farms, they need to be viable in a market-driven food industry. And so they need to be something that a kid who's in high school right now and might be walking by this urban farm in Seattle on his way to school, or might volunteer, or might go with his parents to pull out some greens every once in a while, he can see that as a career choice maybe in 10 years or in 5 years when he goes to college, and then he starts to study business, and maybe he looks at bringing healthy food into a community or on a larger scale distributing healthy food. Maybe that needs to become more of a career as opposed to just, you know, something that you do in your spare time or do and maybe there's no money involved. There's no sustainability in that.
What were some of the approaches of the firms you visited to trying to become profitable? What were the considerations?
Well, in Kansas City is a great example. Cultivate Kansas City is a program that's kind of an umbrella organization that supports markets and supports growers. And they've really tried to connect the growers, anyone from this rogue guerrilla grower, as they call them, you know, on a corner lot who's just doing it part-time while she's got another part-time job, she's growing produce, connecting someone like that or someone like the refugee farmers with the incubator farms to markets all across the city. So crossing kind of the economic lines and bringing food from all parts of the city to different markets, like, you know, the higher-end neighborhoods all the way down to the middle and lower-income neighborhoods, and just crossing all those boundaries with markets. So, I mean, obviously you got to have a place to sell your food no matter how well you grow it. So that's been one way. In Grays Lake, Illinois, which is north of Chicago, which is the Perry Urban Farm example that I mentioned earlier, in a residential development. So you've got somewhat of a captive audience, and that there's hundreds of homes and there's a train line connecting them 45 minutes into Chicago. But the farm there, the 50-acre organic farm, is a brilliant source of food for those people who live there. And that couple that's running that farm, they're averaging $20,000 an acre there, whereas in the heartland of America, which is just outside the fences of this community, corn and the monocrops that we see that are kind of devastating our farmland, those are making $800 an acre. So when you look at numbers like that, even if they're off by a little bit here and there, it's enticing, because when you start growing in that intensive method, biodiverse vegetables that are going to feed people and that are going to sell to feed people, you can make more of a profit.
What would you say are the key challenges to the urban farms that want to become profitable?
Scale is big. Again, they're working on square footage in a lot of places versus acres. And I think those social motivations, social service motivations, can sometimes hold it back because they're not just going out and getting whatever labor they can find and producing as much as possible. You know, again, they're trying to hit on a bunch of different cylinders, and they're trying to use those jobs and the work that is needed on the farm to help college students or to train high school students or to train the homeless. So when they're trying to kind of mix those two worlds, like high-duty production with a social service that's going to help members of the community, sometimes it doesn't fire on all cylinders, I guess. If you were a CEO looking at that, you might say, whoa, what are we doing here? If we want to make top dollar, here's what we need to do, streamline all that. When you're trying to go for that triple bottom line, sometimes those things get overlapped and it, you know, it's not the most efficient, I guess, at times.
I think it's also a challenge to try to convince people to look at the urban farm for their food. I think most people in many of these communities have been sort of entrenched in the food comes from the grocery store and that's where they go. And if sometimes they don't have a grocery store, it comes from the corner market. So, you know, some of it's not necessarily on the farm side. It's on the consumer side. The farm's trying to convince the consumer to start looking at the urban farm as a source for their food. And that's breaking some traditions that have been longstanding in our food system and trying to convince them that they can eat, that this single plot downtown can provide food. In Birmingham, Alabama, they have pretty much a market every day from 4 to 6, I think. So you can go there and get fresh produce every day, and trying to convince the people in that community that that is available, I think, is a challenge for many urban farms.
How much of our needed food can urban farms contribute?
Not all of it, by any stretch. These are not mass production farms. But the farmers are conscious of that. There's no intention here of we're going to feed the masses with this urban farm movement. You know, the idea is we're going to grow good food. And more importantly, we're going to show people, lots of people, because we're in an urban environment and we have access to lots of people, especially lots of young people. We're going to show them where food comes from. And Annie Novak, again, at Eagle Street Rooftop Farm in Brooklyn, speaks really eloquently and passionately about that. She's growing on 6,000 square feet. You know, there's no way she's ever going to feed even the people in that Fort Greene neighborhood. But she can bring in thousands of youth and adults every year, thousands of them, to look at this farm and to stand in the soil in the middle of Brooklyn, looking across the river at Manhattan, and have kids pull a carrot out of the ground and have them hold a chicken. And that will hopefully turn their attention toward healthy food coming out of the outlying areas in upstate New York and farms there that are producing great food. And again, it's about creating a better consumer.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guests are David and Michael Hansen, co-authors with Edwin Marty of the book Breaking Through Concrete, Building an Urban Farm Revival. What has been the response of communities so far to the urban farms?
There's always a mixed response. Not always, but in a lot of cases. In Philadelphia, the Greensgrove farm went in a couple decades ago with a woman named Mary Seton Corboy, just wanted to start growing hydroponic greens, again, to sell to those high-end restaurants, and started on a vacant lot in a kind of an underserved immigrant neighborhood in Philly. And the neighbors weren't into it. Mary's partner actually ended up walking away from the project because he couldn't handle it. There's vandalism. They were throwing rocks at him. There's a lot of antagonism from the community, a key to a lot of these farms, because they are in neighborhoods where people aren't attuned, like a lot of us who are listening here probably, to how great an urban farm is. And so they see these people come in and they're like, what are these people doing in our neighborhood? We've never seen them before. And now they're making this food that they're going to sell to other people outside. It's kind of this colonial feel. So connecting with your neighbors and finding out ways that you can integrate them and they can integrate with you in the neighborhood. Mary Seton Corboy started growing products in her nursery that she saw on people's windowsills around the neighborhood. And so things that she might not have grown otherwise, and now the people are saying, oh, that's the stuff I want, and they come into the farm, and then they buy stuff, and now they have the connection. So creating that connection and engaging on both sides between the farm and the community is key to kind of solidifying those relations.
Would you like to speak in detail about one of your favorite urban farms?
I love the Vietnamese community in East New Orleans. They're the ones who grew out in their backyards. They came over after the Vietnam War, so they're another immigrant community. They've been here for 30 years now. But they grow every square inch of their yards is covered in these greens, and greens that you've never seen. They're seeds from Vietnam. So they're going into their pho bowls and their noodles and their soups that they're making in their house every day. And then the excess is sold at markets. And the market down the street is like a little shopping center. It looks like an American shopping center, but all the signs are in Vietnamese, and they're selling food in baskets and in crates, and it looks like a market out of Vietnam. And so that's really cool, the way that they've just kind of assimilated their culture to the situation in East New Orleans. And after Katrina, that community came back faster than any other part of New Orleans. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons behind that, but you can't deny the fact that their food security, which food security is a big thing that's being talked about now, and especially around natural disasters. And they say that Seattle has 3 days of food if we were to be in a serious natural disaster. And the fact that those East New Orleans folks are able to grow and store food in their backyards and throughout their neighborhood was a big factor in them being able to come back and not worry about the food part of things and get on to the other pieces of the recovery after Katrina.
I guess mine might be Birmingham, Alabama, Jones Valley Urban Farm. I grew up in Atlanta and lived in Alabama for a couple years in Birmingham, and I watched that farm grow from a tiny little sliver in an extremely low-income area and really thrive. I was there for 4 years, and by the time I left, it was a full city block in the heart of downtown. And you know, it really is, it's interesting when you see urban farming across the country, and some places like Santa Cruz and even in Seattle, it's a big topic, and it's not that out of the ordinary. But in Birmingham, Alabama, it is. And being downtown right next to the highway, and it went kind of the heart of the problem almost. And that's what was great to see, was a really great, well-run farm in the heart of an area that really needed an urban farm. And that was great to see, everything from the chickens and all the stuff they're growing, and it's the education part of it, selling to restaurants, farmers markets. That had to be one of my favorites.
What are some of the key challenges for urban farms? We spoke about profitability earlier, but what else?
Well, I think it speaks to the kind of the demographic who's buying, and reaching a broad spectrum, economic spectrum of consumers is a big concern for a lot of the urban farms, and they know it. Again, Mary Seton Corboy in Philadelphia has 400 plus CSA members, community supported agriculture members, who invest in the farm at the beginning of the year and get shares each week of produce. That's what a CSA is. And with 400 plus members, that's a large enough base that she's been able to experiment in a low income CSA model, which is really, really interesting and important to try and get this same food, make it available to the whole spectrum of economic users. Another piece of the puzzle that's going in on the policy side of things is using food stamps and incorporating food stamps into farmers markets, so that there's actually swipe machines now that they're putting in food markets so that people can bring their food stamp card and swipe it and either be matched dollar for dollar or just use their dollars for fresh produce versus, you know, a lot of places, if you have the food stamp card, you can only use it at stores where it's accepted, and a lot of times those stores don't have healthy food. And so when we start getting those into the farmers markets and into these farms where you can buy direct from the farm, then you're going to access a broader range of consumers.
I think the other challenge is the legislature side and policy of changing the laws so that it makes it easier to start an urban farm. In some communities, it's illegal to have chickens in the city, and fighting those laws and those barriers is important. And if the laws and the regulations are set up to encourage urban farming, then I think you'll see more and more people doing that, either it's in their backyard or starting a community plot.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I like what someone said, is that there's a sense that Americans have a right to cheap food. And I think that urban farms are showing us that we have a right to affordable, healthy food. So I like that sentiment.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You have just been listening to David and Michael Hansen, co-authors with Edwin Marti of the book Breaking Through Concrete, Building an Urban Farm Revival, published in 2012 by the University of California Press. For more information, check on the web at breakingthroughconcrete.com. Again, that's breakingthroughconcrete.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.